If you don't have an Election Day hangover yet, there is more to come, as we'll talk about some few surprises in a few races, including the nationally watched U.S. Senate races between Democrat Kyrsten Sinema and Republican Martha McSally. This remains too close to call. We may not know the official outcome until the end of this week. One that the Associated Press has called is a race for Secretary of State, even though Democrat Katie Hobbs has insisted it's not over. Here's her Republican opponent, Steve Gaynor.
Not every vote has been counted. My opponent has not called me. But the AP is rarely wrong.
At this hour, the numbers show Gaynor with a 42,000-vote lead. He's 51.3% of the vote, while Hobbs has 48.7%. One Democrat who is now a congressman-elect in Arizona's 9th Congressional District is former Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton, who easily defeated Republican Steve Ferrara by 19 points.
I would not be here sitting on this, standing on this stage now, if it were not for independents who have put their faith in me, and Republicans who cross party lines to say that we deserve better.
That is Congressman-elect Greg Stanton, and with us now to talk about some of the key races from Election Day, including those that haven't been decided yet, are Paul Bentz of High Ground and Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners. Guys, thanks for being here.
Yeah, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, let's start off with Sinema McSally. Need to get some observations on that. There are obviously many, many more ballots still to be counted at this point. A narrow lead for Martha McSally, and a poll that you did not long ago showed Martha McSally winning by a point. Did those trends indicate to you, did they stay close to what you expected?
One of the things that our survey showed with McSally by one point was that she was doing incredibly well in rural Arizona, which we see reflected in the ballot results tonight. She did incredibly well in Cochise County, Mojave County, Pinal, and Yavapai, about a 69,000 vote advantage, whereas Sinema did incredibly well in Maricopa County, which we saw. She's actually winning by 9,000 votes right now. But with 300,000 plus votes left, mostly in Maricopa County, we could see a shift.
Hey, Marilyn, what do you think about with all those outstanding ballots still there and Sinema winning Maricopa County at this point? Mark and I were discussing before the program, for a Democrat to win Maricopa and Pima and do well in Coconino and other counties, it almost seems amazing that she could possibly lose.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And we know that right now Maricopa accounts for only 56% of ballots counted thus far, so expected to be disproportionately Maricopa County going forward, though I would still call it too close to call. But generally speaking, historically, if you win these two counties and the rurals, you can expect to take that seat.
Well, does this signal a shift? I mean, we saw, for example, 4 years ago with David Garcia, who won Maricopa County and lost the race for superintendent of public instruction. Is it not enough anymore for a Democrat to win Maricopa County, to win a statewide office?
You know, I think that was an anomaly, honestly. It's generally the case that if you win the two biggest counties, you win. I think overlooking the rural counties, though, is a big mistake. And that is something that, a lesson that I think Democrats learned this year, specifically Kyrsten Sinema.
I wonder if we're going to look back and this is going to be the Hillary Clinton didn't go to Wisconsin moment, that the Republicans did a really big victory tour the last couple of days of the election. They spent time in Mojave County, in Yuma, southern Arizona, and then did the big rally at the, you know, steps in Prescott. And I think when we see 69,000 extra votes for McSally coming out of some of those rural areas, that's making the difference right now.
Are those in some cases rural Democrats voting for McSally?
I think there's some of that for sure. I also think, you know, while there's some concern in the metro areas about McSally's military sort of sticking with that messaging all the way through, in those rural areas, it seems to have transcended, and that was something that was attractive.
Marilyn, Sinema, without question, I think even if she was too independent in some cases for some progressives, most people would say she ran a great campaign and was even seen as a front runner. What does it say to you that a Democrat with the registration disadvantage and the fact she had to get so many independents, we don't know the outcome yet, but what do you think about the respective campaigns and how they were run?
Oh, I think they both ran tremendous campaigns, right? And ultimately, it came down to issues, which, I mean, this is a historic moment. There's a woman who's going to the U.S. Senate in Arizona. I'm very excited about that. And ultimately, you know, what we heard the most from both campaigns was about the Affordable Care Act, about pre-existing conditions, and about health care. I think this is a number one issue for voters, and they were both very, very smart to run on that issue.
The conventional wisdom had been before the election that it might be a little while before we actually know the results. We mentioned that it could be up to several days. Paul, do you anticipate by the time this week is over, knowing who won this race?
It's a conundrum. I don't know why we cannot figure out how to get these ballots in and counted. It seems every time that it gets worse and worse. We don't even know how many ballots. Hopefully by 10 a.m. this morning, we'll know. But I've heard everything from 300,000 to 800,000. We're looking at turnout above 2 million, so it will be record voter turnout. We just don't know what's left out there yet. So it's going to be hard. I don't think we'll know until later this week, early next.
And when you look at, you kind of alluded to this, when you look at how many ballots are still outstanding, when you're trying to figure out who will win this race and maybe a few others statewide, how critical is it where those ballots are? Because when you're running a race like this, not all ballots yet to be counted are created equally, right?
Absolutely. As Marilyn said, there's a disproportionate share of these late ballots that are going to be in Maricopa County. We know Sinema's winning Maricopa County by 9,000 votes right now. That trend should continue. The question is there enough of a gap? That's a pretty small lead. It's not some commanding lead. Is that enough to overcome the 16,000 vote gap that we see right now?
Marilyn, do you think there are enough ballots left in, for example, Maricopa and Pima County, if those trends continue, that Sinema could take over?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why you're hearing everybody be so careful today and calling it too close to call, right? You have 500,000 ballots at least still out there to be counted. And I think, you know, that's ultimately exciting. I know we want to know results immediately, but to put this into context, our early vote totals surpassed the overall vote totals for 2014. So it takes a while to count those. And I know that recorders across the state and elections officials and administrative staff, thank you to all of you, have been working through the night and will be working for the next couple of days overtime to get these tabulated.
Before polls even opened on Tuesday, 50,000 more independent and unaffiliated voters had already voted, more than had voted in 2014.
Now, I'm going to bring up the color purple and not the novel by Alice Walker, but I need to know how close Arizona is to being purple. Now, in a moment, Marilyn, we're going to talk about legislative races, of course. And as far as the congressional split, Arizona Democrats have the 5-4 split now based on Ann Kirkpatrick's victory yesterday. But still, we look at governor, we look at attorney general, superintendent of public instruction still up for grabs, secretary of state may be as well. But again, state treasurer won by a Republican handily. Is there something that Democrats are not doing at that level to make strides?
Yeah, I think, you know, we as Democrats we're in the minority in pretty much every case. And so winning every single race is definitely not something we can accomplish, but it is definitely something we try to do every cycle, right? So statewide, right, we have a registration disadvantage, and the money, the sheer amount of money alone from the right was tremendous. I don't even know, and I haven't had a chance to look at the just plain numbers of how much money was spent. But ultimately, we do have a cash disadvantage, and I think it really comes down to that. I think, you know, my hot take for this morning is money matters, and that definitely shows here in Arizona.
Well, how controversial. money makes a difference. Arizona is still a red state. You don't have to look any further than the state mine inspector race where, you know, without any money hardly in that race, the mine inspector, Joe Hart, wins with 53%. It's still a net Republican state, but it's got some purple spots. Not a medical condition, but I think there are definitely areas that we can look to where the demographics are shifting. But just because turnout was up, there's no doubt it'll be record midterm turnout, more than 2 million voters expected. It'll be the highest voter total number of voters in a midterm. But it didn't really change the outcomes. There's an assumption that if more voters turn out, they're going to vote a particular way. But the candidates still matter.
We'll probably come back to the Sinema race, which it's amazing to me, the number of independents that she would have had to pull in order to even make it this close, whether it's she wins or not. So what does that tell us about, you know, we have party not designated, we have someone as an independent. We've done studies, we've done interviews like crazy about who the independent voter is, and we keep hearing they're disaffected Republicans or disaffected Democrats. Are some of these people actually more moderate than we thought?
The best thing about the independent group is that they're not a group at all. It's made up of a bunch of disparate parts, and Morrison Institute has done a lot of really good research on this, and what they found is there isn't one quintessential independent. There are moderates in that segment. There are disaffected Republicans far right who just didn't think the party went far right enough, and then far left didn't think that the Democrat Party is progressive enough. So it's a really wide swath of people. So it's really hard to collect them up in one group. But I will say that in our polling, Sinema was winning those 2-1. And I think that's how she made up the gap that typically we experience.
Let me ask a philosophical question before we go to break here. And that is that we've been talking about how turnout has been great. 50,000 more early ballots cast in this midterm than all the votes in 2014. And yet, turnout is still less than 50% in this state. I mean, what is it about, I mean, all of us in this room knew this was happening and we're very much into it, but what is it about the other 50% of people who either didn't know enough or care enough or for whatever reason didn't vote? I mean, high turnout is great, but if it's less than 50%, it's less than 50%.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a lot of work to do when it comes to making voting more accessible and easier. I think Arizona has made great strides in that you can register online to vote, but we still have that arbitrary threshold, a deadline of 30 days out, right? In Arizona, you don't have a constitutional right to vote. We need to take a look at that. And in many countries, Election Day is a day off, right? It's a holiday, right, where you have the time to go out and vote. I think Tuesday, right? You have a lot of individuals out there with one or two or more jobs, students, and so getting to the polls can be very challenging. And so I think there's a lot more that we can do to make it more accessible, and I would really hope to start working on that very soon.
Those who vote, vote. Those who don't, don't. When the president's not at the top of the ballot, lower turnout is expected. We have a massive gap between the two. It's pretty typical, but this was higher turnout than usual.
That's Paul Bentz. Also with us is Marilyn Rodriguez in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein, and you're listening to the show here on 91.5. Good Wednesday morning. It's the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're talking about Election Day with Paul Bentz of High Ground and Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners. Marilyn, one enormous issue in Arizona, of course, based on the Red for Ed movement, was education. Didn't work out so well for David Garcia, but we did see some advances in other areas here.
Red for Ed wave. I think it absolutely had impacts up and down the ballot, especially in Arizona statewide. So we know that more voters voted against 305, Prop 305, that was the voucher expansion bill, than they voted for Ducey. And voters may have entrusted Ducey with a second term, but they simultaneously rejected the centerpiece of his education record. And they want more funding for public schools, no matter which party they voted for, right? And so I think on that note, you know, Ducey did run as a pro-education candidate. You know, he said, you know, he wants teachers to get raises. He says he wants to put more money in education. And so in the second term, I think, you know, we're going to have to hold him accountable to that. And he is going to be expected to fulfill those promises.
Paul?
Education's been the top issue facing the state for over 4 years in our polling. At the moment, immigration surpassed it. That might have to do with a small collection of people headed towards the border. But I expect education to come back. It's been the top issue for quite a while. I think Red for Ed had an impact, absolutely, on a lot of these legislative races, and there was a lot of enthusiasm. But if I were the progressive groups that backed some of these movements, I'd be gobsmacked that you didn't make more of an improvement. I think a sales tax for education would have passed handily, but they went for the massive income tax increase instead. I think they put a lot of backing behind Garcia, which didn't seem to do well. They also thought that 127 with the energy was going to activate the same type of community and really have this big progressive push, and we just haven't seen it.
I disagree. I think we saw a lot of new voters, right? We saw unprecedented turnout. And my hope is that we continue to see that. It takes a long, long time to shift dynamics, to shift the status quo. I cannot remember who this quote is attributed to, but as a student of political science, you hear it a lot. Politics is the slow boring of hard boards, right? You can't expect everything to change on a light switch, right? And so I think hopefully we see in 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, a continuation of the virtuous cycle, a continuation of individuals who have never voted before voting. And I think Red for Ed, Invest in Ed, 127, clean energy, climate change, that had a lot to do with the new voter turnout that we saw.
I agree, but I think SOS had probably the biggest impact of all. That was the pure volunteer group that went out and did the impossible, defeated the Ivan Drago of the system, went and really, you know, referred the issue to ballot when no one thought they could, and then rallied grassroots support and defeated 305. I think that's the basis of what's going on, and that plus the teachers who decided to run. I think more teachers who run for office, the better. I think we will see more education advocates in the legislature long term. But I think when 20 for 20, the governor's plan passed, I think the governor could say, look, I gave teachers a raise. And it's very difficult to argue with that, whether you believe those raises are real or not.
Paul, based on the polling, does it seem like there's a consensus about what top education issues are? Because to say education is a big issue, there's a lot of potential things in there that people can sort of pull out. Did you find a consensus?
Even the plurality of Republicans think that our schools are underfunded. So there is a desire to put more money into the schools. The question always comes down to where it's spent. If you say more money in the classroom, it's an incredibly well poll-tested issue. Less money for administration is another one. But at the end of the day, it's teacher pay. There is an overwhelming desire among all segments to support teacher pay.
So, Marilyn, if this is sort of the long game, then, if you can't expect, even in this Twitter, Facebook world where we want everything 5 minutes ago, if this is something that might be happening over the course of a few cycles, what do Democrats and education advocates have to do going forward to make sure that the trajectory continues?
Raise revenue. And that's really what was behind the Invest in Education movement, right? And the Red for Ed movement was calling for more revenue. Ultimately, whether you want to paper over it or not, the legislature failed to meet the demands of Red for Ed. Those are still there. We still have thousands of unfilled teacher positions that have full-time substitutes in them. And as Paul mentioned, we still have an underfunded public education system. And we can't fund it without finding more money. And I think, you know, with the passage of 126, which is the prohibition on service taxation,
right.
That I really think we're going to regret in the very near future. It's taken a lot of options off the table. So if you were opposed to income tax hikes, I have bad news for you. It's now one of two options. And we have already, I think, stretched beyond what is, I think, reasonable or appropriate on the sales tax.
Yeah, Paul, 126 didn't get a lot of attention, but it may end up being extremely impactful here.
Yes, it's going to be incredibly impactful. We did some polling on it early on, and clearly what we found was that it was risking failure. We were obviously wrong on that. There was a lot of confusion. I think 127 contributed to that. There was a lot of when people sat down, I think, looked at the ballot language was very forgiving for 126. It sounded good. No new taxes, you know, particularly on these hardworking services. There is a reason why both gubernatorial candidates were opposed to it, is because it does hamstring our revenue sources. I do think it will create long-term challenges. But hats off to the realtors who, you know, put $8 million in this campaign and won pretty handily.
Yes, they excluded themselves from taxation, so we'll have to deal with that. And I think as far as the long-term felt impacts from short-sighted ballot measures, you have Prop 108, which now a lot of voters didn't realize. You know, the two-thirds for taxes amendment also means two-thirds for ending the sweetheart deals, for ending corporate welfare. So we have millions and millions of dollars that we just hand out to corporations every year. We can't undo that. Our legislature can't undo that without two-thirds votes. And so I think that's another thing that we're going to have to look at, whether we need to structurally change our ability to raise revenue and untie the hands of lawmakers in order to fund infrastructure in this state.
We want to talk briefly about some of the really down ballot races. Marilyn, you'd mentioned legislative races, and there had been talk that maybe Democrats could tie or take control of the state Senate. That didn't happen, but they did make some pretty significant gains in the state House.
Yes. So I think, you know, we voted as Democrats, and I think just as Arizonans in general, to put a check on Republicans. Overall, you know, Republicans lost seats in the Senate. So they lost seats in the House. They may lose the House. And we are looking at the least amount of seats for Republicans in a generation, right? So I think down ballot, what you were seeing is a referendum on the fact that there is a lot that has gone unaddressed. And a hunger out there by voters for something to change. And hopefully we will know in the next couple of days whether that remains to be the case.
I think Democrats ran some very quality candidates and were very strategic in the areas they went. And you look at places like LD 17, where you have a teacher run. In the Chandler area, a single teacher run against two Republicans. She has a shot to win that race. You look in some of the swing areas in the Ahwatukee area, LD 18, and in the Arcadia area, LD 28. Both of those look poised to actually have two Democrats represent. Just recently was a split delegation. So I think there's some changes there. I think education does play a role in those, as well as the superintendent of public instruction race, where Riggs is only up by less than 7,000 votes right now.
Paul Bentz of High Ground, Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Election Day in Arizona was another successful one for Republicans in statewide races and a few races, including the nationally watched U.S. Senate race between Democrat Kyrsten Sinema and Republican Martha McSally, remain too close to call. We may not know the official outcome until the end of this week. Now, there were two GOP incumbents who won comfortably, Governor Doug Ducey and Attorney General Mark Brnovich. Brnovich defeated Democrat January Contreras. And though Brnovich aggressively criticized Tom Steyer for spending money to defeat him, he also talked about why he thinks he was the winner.
Right now, we're in the middle of litigation against the Board of Regents and the state universities over dramatic tuition increases. I think that's an issue that no one's talked about, and no one's been wanting to take on the sacred cows at the universities, and I think it's important as a protector of the taxpayers that I do that.
Meanwhile, Governor Ducey defeated David Garcia by more than 17 points in coasting to re-election. In his concession speech, Garcia thanked educators for their support.
You are not going to go back to your classrooms passively. You're not going to go back quietly. You are not going to go back and take what has really been taken from you, and that is you're not going to go back to an underfunded, maligned public school system.
Now, with us now to talk about some of the key races from Election Day, including those that haven't been decided yet, are Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting and Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Chad, analyze this Sinema McSally race. We've discovered that about 500,000 ballots remain to be counted. At this point, Sinema's down by about 15,000 votes. How do you see this playing out?
A long ways to go here, and far too early for anybody to make a prediction, I think, even though that's what we've all been doing for months now. But the big number of ballots seem to be in Maricopa County. Kyrsten is winning in Maricopa County. I think that's something that's kind of being underreported right now. And so I think that's a good trend to look at. My gut is that as these ballots come in, Kyrsten continues to chip away at that lead. And there's more than enough ballots out there for her to overcome that. Will she overcome that at the end of the day? I'm not sure. But I think the potential is there. It's going to be a long next 2 or 3 days here, I think, as we all wait and see what these results are.
Emily, except for a couple of outlying polls, which seem to be strange, having 6 or 7 point spreads, many of them showed this race to be right. 1 or 2 points, and that's what we're seeing. So ultimately, what made the difference, or why was it so close? Are these two good candidates? Do we have Kyrsten Sinema grabbing so many independents? What came out for you?
I think it's two strong candidates. I think it's Martha McSally doing a good job at turning out Republicans who vote in big numbers. Republicans like to vote in Arizona. And then I think it's Kyrsten Sinema, running a great strategic play to go after those independent voters and moderate Republicans. And that's what's kept it really tight the whole time.
Chad, depending on how this race ends up playing out, what lessons do you think future Democratic candidates for Senate or other statewide offices might take from how Kyrsten Sinema ran her campaign? Because she did not run, many would say, as a traditional Democrat. She didn't talk about being a Democrat much. The word independent was much more prominent than her actual party affiliation.
Yeah, I think the big thing, though, is she stuck to the issues that mattered to the voters. She talked about health care, which is the number one issue for every voter. She was relentless on that time and time again. And quite frankly, we didn't see that from the gubernatorial candidate who should have been talking about education, healthcare, but somehow started talking about abolishing ICE and tearing down the wall. That just made no sense in this environment. So I think the biggest lesson to take away from what Kyrsten was doing, and other candidates too, I think there's other good campaigns this cycle, was talking about the issues that resonated with a majority of voters, not just a particular subset of base voters. And that's what you have to do as a Democrat in the state right now.
Well, and apparently pretend to not be much of a Democrat. I mean, that's sort of a trend we're seeing across the country in some of these races. I think you're going to see Grant Woods do it in a few years as well.
Well, let me ask you sort of the flip side of that. Chad mentioned David Garcia kind of got away from some of the issues that a lot of people think he should have been talking about. So when you look at the margin in the governor's race, was Governor Ducey that strong a candidate, and does he have that strong of a record, or was he going against a candidate who was a little more flawed?
Yes to both. He's a strong candidate. He's got a pretty solid record with Republicans. He's navigated the Trump issues very well. But he didn't have much of an opponent at all. In fact, Garcia, I think, hurt all the Democrats. We did not see a blue wave last night, and that's, I think, largely because of David Garcia. If he had stayed on point with education, he could have kept that 75,000-strong teacher protest movement going all the way into November, and we would have been seeing some different outcomes last night.
And I would agree. Well, I'll say one thing. I don't think Ducey's a great candidate, to be honest with you. I don't think he's a horrible candidate. I don't think he's great. his numbers aren't that solid. He's not really popular. He's not really unpopular. He's just kind of there. And even some Republicans have said, even Bob Robb has written a column about this. He doesn't really proactively address issues. He kind of just reacts to issues. And when he reacts, he's a lot of times actually gets it right, but he's kind of a reactive governor. And I think had Steve Farley, for instance, gotten through the primary, I think you would have seen a more competitive race. But I will agree with Emily again. I'll reiterate this. I think that Garcia should have stayed focused on education 24/7. I don't know why he didn't. And I do think that hurt his race, obviously, as well as some other races down ticket. But I will say, Dems had a really good night last night. We still have a couple statewide races that could go our way. We picked up 4 seats right now in the House, possibly 5. We picked up the congressional majority in this state. It was a good night for Dems. I don't want to say that it wasn't, because it was a very good night for Democrats last night.
But a couple of things you're citing have to do with redistricting to some extent. We talk about legislative races and congressional races, which, of course, we're going to see in 2 to 4 years a difference there. Not saying there weren't good candidates, but the statewide races are not affected by that. Yeah. And considering how big an issue education was, we may end up seeing Kathy Hoffman win superintendent.
Yeah,
we don't know
I think she will.
But that should have been such a really an easy paint-by-numbers issue for Democrats, as you mentioned with Garcia. Why didn't the momentum from Save Our Schools and Red for Ed take hold of almost all Democratic candidates?
Well, at the legislative level, though, I will say the campaigns that won last night all campaigned on education. All of the candidates that won last night on the Democratic side in the legislature were running on education. And a lot of these candidates actually came out of that Red for Ed movement, so they actually continue that momentum. The problem with the superintendent race, honestly, is most people just don't pay attention to it. And I think it's more of a reflection of upper-ticket races. And to Emily's point, I think when Garcia started talking about things that weren't education-related, it affected other races down ballot.
Yeah, including Kyrsten Sinema's race. You know, imagine if we had a dynamic Democratic
candidate.
Well, don't
say imagine when you're talking about David Garcia, because then we're going to have to hear the imagine.
if we had a dynamic Democratic candidate running for governor that was really – that people thought they had a chance, we might be able to get him through. You would have seen a much more enthusiastic Democratic turnout, which would have benefited everyone.
Does it matter sort of the unity of the ticket? We saw the Republican slate sort of barnstorming the state in the last couple of days. Not so much on the Democratic side. Emily, does that matter?
Oh, it absolutely matters. You know, there's strength in that team and that slate, especially for those less noticed, less popular races. And you saw the Republicans sort of misstep on that, too. In District 28, they were sending out mailers that included an entire Republican slate. They left off Maria Sims. There was an intramural squabble going on among Republicans in that district. They picked a side. You've got Sims now trailing by 600 votes in third place, and the Republicans won't hold either of those seats in the House.
Chad, did it hurt Democrats, you think, that there wasn't maybe that unity, or at least they didn't pretend to be unified and travel around and have all the slate of statewide candidates speaking?
Maybe. I'm not sure about the unified front as much as just more the unified messaging to some degree. I think that a lot of the campaigns that Hoffman, Hobbs, you know, January Contreras, actually all of the other statewide campaigns did a really good job. They stuck to their messaging. They focused on what was really going to be the winning message for a broad cross-section of voters. But I've been saying this for, you know, a month or two now. Garcia's strategy from day one was to try to turn out enough voters from the base and really the younger population to win an election. And honestly, we're just not there yet in Arizona. It's simply impossible to do that in Arizona. It may be possible in 2022 in the next governor's race, but it just isn't possible right now. And I think last night that bared out. And I've been saying this for weeks, and some Democrats have gotten mad at me. We're getting killed in rural Arizona, and it happened again. Right now, Sinema and Hoffman are winning in Maricopa County but losing in rural Arizona, and that is something Democrats have to come to terms with, and we have to start doing a better job of campaigning in rural Arizona. And that's not a criticism. I think Kyrsten and Hoffman and others did it this time, but they were starting from a regressive point from the past previous election cycles. So,
and when you say party platform issues are going to have to change a little bit for Democrats too to appeal to rural Arizonans,
I don't think so. I think our platform issues agree with rural Arizona. We just need to go talk to them about it. We care about water and infrastructure and education in rural Arizona. We just need to talk to them about those issues more. And I think, and I'm not trying to be too critical. I don't want to sound like that, but I just, myself included in this, I think we've lost sight of that in rural Arizona. And I'm not pulling myself out of this conversation. I'm part of that problem. We just have to do a better job. And I do think Kyrsten and Hoffman and others, Katie, did a good job at the cycle. I just think it was we still have a long ways to go out there, is all I'm saying.
And Emily, one name we haven't mentioned yet is President Trump. And President Trump's very popular in rural Arizona and among rural Democrats even to some extent. So
absolutely.
is that disconnect that we're seeing urban versus rural in another way?
I think so. And Trump is such a polarizing figure. You love him or you hate him. You know, even if you're a Republican and you like what he's doing, sometimes you bristle at the way he says and delivers his message. But, yeah, I think when you look at rural Arizona voters, they are pragmatic. Whether they're Democrat or Republican, they're doers. Let's get something done. Let's see results. You know, and you've got to be able to communicate and connect on that level. And I think he does a better job of that.
Are there potentially lessons for Democrats in the way someone like Tom O'Halloran runs his races?
Yeah, I mean, I think O'Halloran does a very good job of running in rural Arizona. I actually think, you know, I think Kirkpatrick does a good job of that, too. She used to represent that district. And again, I think there's a lot of candidates that do a good job of that in individual areas. Just at the statewide level, we just haven't really been able to connect with rural Arizona voters since Janet Napolitano, to be honest with you. And so I think we need to just kind of reassess and regroup on that front. That's all I'm getting at. But there's water and infrastructure, two areas where Democrats should be making inroads in rural Arizona.
And to your point, Steve, you saw Tom O'Halloran sitting at the table with Donald Trump when he was in town. You know, O'Halloran used to be a Republican. He knows how to speak Republican. So that made a difference for him.
That's Emily Ryan. Also here is Chad Campbell with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. More Election Day analysis. You can't wait for it after this. Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're discussing Election Day results and some races that haven't been decided yet with Chad Campbell of Strategies 360 and Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting.
Guys, there had been a little bit of talk before Election Day that on the state legislature level, Democrats could potentially tie the Senate or maybe even take control of the Senate. That it looks like the split, the 17-13 Republican advantage, will stay there. But in the House, a different story. Emily, what happened?
Well, you know, I think you make a really great point because we were getting emails, save the Senate, from the evil Democrats like Chad. And there was a lot of emphasis on that. And as it turns out, they were all fine. And now it looks like we're losing 4 seats in the House. There just wasn't a big effort on holding those numbers. The Republicans will still have, I think, they'll still have the 31 majority, but that's really close to an even split.
That's the bare minimum you need to pass
that. Bare minimum, yeah.
Chad, was it a lack of effort, do you think, on Republicans' part?
No, I think it was just really, really good candidates on the Democratic side. And again, I predicted this one. It's in writing in the Republic.
Hey, Chad.
In writing in the Republic on Monday. You know, I said the surprise is going to be the state House. And I said there's going to be 3 to 6 seats at flip. Right now we're looking at 4. There's an outside shot of 5, actually, up north. Felicia French is still just a few hundred votes behind up there. I don't think that's going to happen, but it could. But the bottom line is we had really good candidates running on education and healthcare for the most part. That's what they ran on. That's what they talked about. A couple of them were part of the Red for Ed movement. They came from that movement. They did what every candidate should have been doing, was to continue that momentum from the end of last legislative session into this campaign cycle, and that's exactly what they did. We had great candidates and a great effort from the Democratic Party in this cycle, so it was really good to see that happen.
Now, Chad, you served in the House for a number of years.
Remind me of that, but yes, I did, yes.
We won't hold that against you. How does a 31-29 split affect things? Because as we discussed, you need 31 votes to pass something. Republicans will, if that is the margin, they have no margin for error.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. So, especially on issues where you see some, you know, crossover, education, some of the issues we just talked about, water possibly, things like that that are not traditionally or fall in the traditional partisan lines. If the GOP loses one vote, they may not get something passed. And to be honest with you, that's what the state needs. We need some compromise. I hope that this is maybe the beginning of more communication between the House members at least and the governor's office and maybe the Senate, and maybe forcing some compromise and actually getting some really good policy done for a change, because it needs to happen in Arizona.
And Emily, state Senate's going to stay at 17-13. I want to stick with LD-28 briefly. We talked about this a bit last night. Is Kate Brophy McGee potentially the only moderate Republican who remains in the state Senate?
Well,
and did it make that race even more pivotal?
You know, it does make the race pivotal. You know, I don't know. We don't know what Tyler Pace is going to be like. There's some
Bob
speculation
Worsley's
he's going to be a Bob Worsley-ish kind of person, but he has no record, so we'll see when he gets there. You know, if you talk to him, he'll tell you he's an independent person and no one tells him what to think or what to do. So
don't all politicians say that, though, at some point?
They do, yeah, they do. That's a pretty common thing. But, yeah, we're going to have a pretty conservative Senate, and we're going to have a conservative executive branch, and that's going to be sort of the Republican stronghold there. Chad said, you know, all they have to do is peel off one Republican in the House. The other effect that the tight numbers are going to have in the House is that you're going to have a couple Democrats who are willing to burn their party and flip, and they're going to become really popular and highly courted by Republicans for that safety buffer on close votes.
Mark and I discussed this off air. How do you think this affects leadership as far as Speaker goes? Are we going to see a more moderate Speaker potentially in the House?
You know, I think Speaker, you know, they've been running and counting votes for a while, and those talks are going to happen here in the next couple of days. You've got Rusty Bowers and Mark Fincham both vying for it, and it's going to be Republicans that decide who the Speaker is. Democrats won't play in that if they're not eking into that majority.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it works. Unless somehow Felicia French pulls off an upset up in LD6 up north and closes that gap, then, you know, it's going to be a two-seat majority for the GOP. And, yeah, they'll decide the Speaker. But again, I do think, though, that on some of the bigger issues and some of the issues that we know have to be addressed, like education, it's going to force a little more dialogue in the House. I do believe that. And I go back to when I was down there and we did Medicaid expansion, when I worked with Jan Brewer on that one. You know, we had lower numbers than they're going to have next session now on our side. And we worked with the moderate ours and Brewer to pass that really, really big piece of legislation. And things like that will be even more important now with that slim majority for the GOP in the House.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we might be seeing more issues like that. I mean, I don't remember the year, but there was a year where some moderate Republicans and Democrats in the House got together and passed a budget over the objection of the Speaker of the House at the time that the Senate approved and Governor Napolitano signed into law. You mentioned Medicaid expansion. Is it possible that we could see more issues like that where a couple Republicans peel off with Democrats? Or is it more likely, as Emily suggested, maybe a couple Democrats will peel off and join the Republicans to pass maybe what they would have passed anyway?
I probably think it could go both ways depending on the issue. But the big one I see, I keep repeating myself here, is education. I think something has to be done around education, and I do think it has to be from a kind of a quote-unquote moderate viewpoint, because I think the business community is going to be involved, and there's going to be a lot of outside education groups involved, and that's where I see in the House a potential coalition of D's and R's coming together to work with Ducey to put something real together to fund education. And fingers crossed, I'm not trying to be naive, but that's what I could see potentially happening now.
Yeah, but you've got to get that passed a really strongly Republican Senate and signed by the governor. And the problem with that is a lot of the Republicans that went ahead and voted for the budget that included Ducey's fix that some in education would say is lackluster and not enough and criticize, there were Republicans that were compromising by voting yes on that because they didn't feel like even that should be done. And so that's what you're trying to bridge. So, you know, I'm not as optimistic.
But I would say this. Again, the candidates who won last night from the D side campaigned on education. That's what they campaigned on. And Brophy McGee won because of education or is going to possibly win because of education. If something isn't done around education in the next 2 years and we go to 2020 without a fix, they're going to pay the price, the legislators who are not voting for education. I'm telling you that right now, and that's why I think that will be a big issue over the next two sessions.
Emily, in our last few minutes, let's talk about energy, electricity rates. Mm-hmm. At least at this point, it appears that two Republicans will win the two seats, one who's technically an incumbent in Justin Olsen, the other
one. Glassman's a Republican today, right?
Right.
Just
well,
checking.
Yeah,
just checking. Yeah. Sorry. Couldn't resist, yeah.
He's getting it from both sides. It's not a great place to be, I suppose. So how do you see this as far as Corporation Commission? We saw Prop 127 went down in flames.
In flames.
Is there, though, the fact that this was out there and the fact that it appears, based on polling, that many Arizonans want there to be more of an emphasis on alternative forms of energy, on solar energy? Is a commission, even an all-Republican panel, going to move toward changing the renewable energy standard? Is that something they should be thinking about?
I think so. I think the Republicans you will see on the Corporation Commission are going to consider those things. You know, even renewable energy is coming down in price. It's not as costly as it once was. And that's sort of a practical way that's going to push them that direction. You're not going to see huge mandates. You're going to see a lot of lot more of the same. And with you mentioning 127 going down, you know, what that says to me is Tom Steyer's money is not welcome in Arizona, because he sure dumped a lot of money into the state, and I think voters told him to keep it in California.
Yeah, and I've heard that Steyer narrative, and I mean, yes and no. I kind of agree and disagree at the same time. I think the bigger reason 127 went down was I think there were a lot of scare tactics from the no one 127 side about the your rates going up, your bill going up every month. And I also think it was a very complicated ballot measure. And I think the lesson to be learned here, because I do think renewable energy is supported across the board, polling shows it, lesson to be learned here is if and when this effort comes back in whatever way, shape, or form, if it's a ballot measure, if it's something at the CorpCom, you know, make it a little more simplistic, make it a little more straightforward, and I think you'll have an easier time selling the voters on it. But there were a lot of scare tactics during that campaign, and a lot of people didn't know what to believe because it is a complicated issue. So I think the people just voted no, and that's their default position.
Emily, had this plan, the same exact plan, come from the Corporation Commission as opposed to being put into the state constitution? We heard the narrative about Tom Steyer. Would it have gotten more support? I mean, would the public maybe be more in support of it than they were of 127?
I think if it had come from the Corporation Commission and APS was behind it, you would have seen
Bingo.
Some more public support. That's what I think. But, you know, to Chad's criticism or defense of Tom Steyer, you know, look at him going after Mark Brnovich. Again, a big belly flop.
Brnovich didn't seem that excited about it last night.
No, he didn't. But Steyer just, you know, took a match to piles of money. You know, he was not terribly effective in Arizona.
Oh, and I'm not saying – I don't disagree on that. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying I think – I don't know if the Steyer narrative resonates with the average voter. I just think the language is a little too complicated. And I think your key point, you said if APS blessed it, let's not over gloss what you just said there. I mean,
well, there would have been no opposition if APS blessed it. We'd all be rowing the same direction.
I mean, let's be honest. APS has been standing in the way of a lot of these issues, and that's part of the problem, at least from our side.
All right, guys, let's end on a light note. Do we expect in any way for there to be another dunk tank of any other person at some point? It was weird to have the Attorney General have a dunk tank, but anyway. Anyway, Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting, Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.